What makes a great pair of glasses? At Warby Parker, it's all the invisible extras without the extra cost. Their designer quality frames start at $95, including prescription lenses, plus scratch-resistant, smudge-resistant, and anti-reflective coatings, and UV protection, and free adjustments for life. To find your next pair of glasses, sunglasses, or contact lenses, or to find the Warby Parker store nearest you, head over to warbyparker.com. That's warbyparker.com.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Appreciate you being there, everybody, and thanks for being with us all week long. This hour, we're going to be joined by Mark Dubowitz. He's the CEO of Defense of Democracies. You want to go inside the challenge of the Middle East. You want to go inside what's happening over in Eastern Europe. You want to find out about the challenge of the new alliance of Iran meeting today. China and Russia and North Korea, he's where to go. And General Philip Breedlove is with us now, retired four-star general in the U.S. Air Force, served as commander of the U.S. European Command, and the 17th Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Before we get to the general, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We're here in the name of peace, and we're asking for Mahmoud to be released. He was taken illegally by the ICE department. He was kidnapped by the United States government.
How about soon to be deported? Colombia crackdown. Anti-American pro-Hamas protesters take over Trump Tower. But let's be clear. Trump's America will not allow the higher education embarrassment to succeed. And Colombia knows they can no longer go on without any retribution. They've lost $400 million in grants.
Number two.
I do have leverage, but I don't want to talk about leverage now, because right now we're talking to him, and based on the statements he made today, they were pretty positive, I think. So I don't want to talk about that. I hope Russia is going to make the deal, too.
Vladimir Putin speaks on ceasefire deal and to Donald Trump, and there's more than a little hope to stop the fighting. Talks happening right now in Moscow. A Trump-Putin phone call any minute at NAS NATO makes it clear America leads and will make the alliance stronger.
Number one.
If we enter a shutdown, House and Senate Republicans would pursue a strategy of bringing bills to the floor to reopen only their favorite departments and agencies.
That is Chuck Schumer. He backs down. So no government shutdown, thanks to House Republicans sticking together. He will now be a Democrat. There will not be a Democratic shutdown of the government. And Dems are outraged that Schumer didn't stand stronger. Not at Trump or Johnson, but at their own inability to form any game plan. Bottom line, Schumer had no cards to play, and I think he did the right thing. And I would think McConnell would do the same thing if he was in charge in the minority, too. So let's talk about what's happening. We know about the peace talks in Jeddah, ceasefire talks in Jeddah with Ukrainian officials, at which time they said, yeah, we'll do a 30-day, and here are the parameters. And now it was up to Steve Witkoff to go over to Moscow. In the meantime, President Trump spoke to Vladimir Putin, and he read the deal, and he had some statements to make. General Philip Breedlove joins us now. General, your thoughts about where we're at right now?
Well, good morning, Brian. And the bottom line is we're in a better place than we were weeks ago. So I want to be happy and congratulate the team that has got this ceasefire talks moving forward. I think we have to be very wary of where Mr. Putin is heading in his remarks. You know, the remarks were seen as good, but at the end of the remarks, it's pretty clear that he hasn't committed to a ceasefire. He wants to have more talks before the ceasefire. And what you should read into that is he wants to continue to pound Ukraine to change the facts on the ground to give himself a better negotiating stance.
I think it's time
for our president to get tough with Putin the way he got tough with Zelensky.
One thing is interesting. He's lifted the exemption that European partners of NATO were using in order to buy Russian oil, essentially helping to finance this war against Ukraine. The president said, yeah, I'm not going to have that anymore. That's done. That will hurt Russia big time. And also, I think that Putin was smart. He goes, I thank Trump. Used the term partner. He said, He listed the ceasefire. He says he has some ceasefire-related issues. The way I understand it is Russia wants to control the everything that they've gained. They said the four Ukrainian regions in Donbass, that's a non-starter. The Ukrainian army must be limited, not a million men. They want like 80,000. That's a non-starter. He also made it clear the Western sanctions need to be eased. And then they want to find out some type of resolve with Kursk. Your thoughts about that?
Well, you hit it all right on the head here. You know, essentially, Mr. Putin has set all the terms, and he expects to get all the terms. And he will keep delaying trying to get all his terms so he can continue to pound Ukraine. We, as you watched, and I'm not complaining, but we set up a campaign of extreme pressure on Ukraine. We cut off arms. We cut off intelligence, which cost Ukrainian soldiers' lives on the battlefield. And so now what we have to see is what will it take to get Putin to the table? And if we don't have a plan for a plan of maximum pressure on Putin, then we're not going to get there until he's ready. He's driving the train right now on timing and content. And I believe we have to take the lead and exhibit pressure just like we did against Ukraine.
Yes, absolutely. So here's Mike Waltz, who just got back from Jeddah, talking to Sean Hannity last night, Cut 16.
I would imagine parts, maybe the Donbas region in particular, or areas that are heavily populated by people from Russia, that would go to Putin in any negotiated settlement. Am I wrong in my conjecture here?
Sean, no surprise, you're not wrong in any of that. And what's important is that we are discussing all of those things with both sides. We are having those discussions with our counterparts, with the Russians. We are having those discussions with our counterparts, with the Ukrainians. And we are pushing both sides together with President Trump, the deal maker in chief, that is determined to end this war.
So, you know, obviously he was going to break, but we don't know what area. It's hard to imagine the Russians giving up much of that area. That's pretty clear. They also don't want international troops. Now, for Ukraine and for the U.S., there's got to be international troops, or else, General, it would be the same type of deal we cut in 2016, wouldn't it?
So first, let's go back to the business of land. We should never in any way entertain giving Putin more land than he's conquered. He's demanded the fill-out of those oblasts in the east. And that is a non-starter. That is complete capitulation if we go there. By the same token, the portion of Kursk that Ukraine has grabbed from Russia is a portion that is settled by primarily formerly Ukrainian people, and many of them still speak Ukrainian. And so by the same token, that land should stay with Ukraine. And we'll see if this is actually coming out in the negotiations.
Absolutely. So I talked to the General Secretary of NATO 20 minutes ago, and here's what he said about the alliance and what has begun to change, thankfully.
This act is extremely important. So I think we have two issues. One issue is that the Europeans are not spending enough. But luckily, the last couple of weeks, we have heard staggering amounts of extra money coming in from the Europeans. For example, overnight from Germany, hundreds of billions extra on defense spending. So I think the Europeans are getting the message we have to spend more. But the second issue, of course, is that collectively, and this is including the U.S., we are not producing enough.
So he has gotten one thing that Trump has done. He's gotten Europe's attention, hasn't he?
He has. And you know, we need to recognize that during his first 4 years, we didn't make a lot of progress with Russia. Russia continued to fight on the line of contact. So we didn't change Mr. Putin in any way. But we did begin to change NATO. And many of the NATO partners are now over 2%, and some of them are way over 2%. Rivaling us, Poland and others are really investing in their defense, and that's important. We do give our president some credit for that, but we also give Mr. Putin credit for that, because Mr. Yep. Putin, a world superpower, continues to amass his army, march across internationally recognized borders, and invade and try to subjugate his neighbors. And that has a pretty damning effect on decisions about investment as well. So, yes, credit to our president. Yes, also in a big way, credit to Mr. Putin, because he continues to invade his neighbors. His neighbors are finally getting it. They're going to have to do their business. And just one more second, Brian.
Yep.
You remember, everybody talks about Article 5 in NATO.
Yep.
Article 5 starts with Article 3, which in my Georgia boy words mean defense begins at home. Article 3 tells the nations they have to invest in their own defense and in excess capability then to help defend the alliance. And they're finally getting it that Article 3 precedes Article 5 in that famous document.
Unbelievable. And the thing is, too, after Georgia, after the incursion in 2016, still Europe wasn't spending until Trump said, listen, I'm not think I'm going to do this anymore, and really scared them. I don't think that now I think they take it serious. And then after the Ukraine invaded again, they still weren't spending to the with degree they shouldn't. But now they got 23 of 32 nations going over 2%. So Trump says make it 5. Now, what is the state of also I talked to the general secretary. He wants the president to call it a Defense Production Act and call it an emergency in order to produce more weapons for our allies to buy, let alone us to have. But we have an uphill battle. I was struck by this in testimony on Capitol Hill this week. Dr. Brett Seidel on Capitol Hill talking about the state of our production. Cut 20.
On balance, cost and schedule performance remain challenged, with deliveries approximately 1 to 3 years late and costs rising faster than overall inflation. These issues are prevalent across the nuclear and conventional shipbuilding communities, with both Navy and industry sharing responsibility. Some of our challenges include atrophy of the manufacturing sector, depressed investment, workforce shortages, diminished proficiency, as well as supply chain disruptions.
That comes into the main story today about tariffs and production and manufacturing at home. We got to start doing this to help our own defense, let alone our economy.
And Brian, let's remember, too, there's a lot of shared responsibility here. Every time we have a continuing resolution, it interrupts funding, it breaks many contracts, and in essence, it raises the price and increases the length of delivery of all the major components that are out there. So what we need to do is really get on the business of turning out budgets on time without interrupting cash flows to these contracts, which go up, up, and up every time we break them.
Even when we, in this CR, there's more money for defense, and that still hurts defense?
Every time you have a CR, you break funding streams. And sometimes we get provisions in the CR to not break certain funding streams. But the bottom line is every time the funding is cut off, that is then a break on the government side in the performance of the contract. And this causes some people say, I don't know, and I don't want to start a rumor here, but as much as 17% of cost on our big ticket purchases are due to the disruptions of CRs.
So lastly, today in Beijing, or yesterday with the time change, I'm not sure, there's nuke talks with Iran, Russia, and China, and I might even be North Korea. And they had military exercises together on Tuesday. Your thoughts about this emerging alliance? How real? How much is messaging?
Well, you hit it on the head. It's a little of both. In fact, I think a good amount of it is messaging. But the fact of the matter is we have to take this seriously. I am a believer that China looks at as everybody else as useful lesser brothers. They have done a pretty good job of getting cheap oil and things from Russia to try to curry publicly this union of those two countries in thought. And I really believe that China is the one that's driving this and looking to benefit in the long term from it. But in the shorter term, the fact that most of these nations are providing arms and aid to Russia in its fight against Ukraine is quite demonstrative. I mean, Iran sending weapons, North Korea sending weapons, North Korea sending troops to help save Russia from losing Kursk. Think about this. Russia has had to ask twice now for North Korean help to try to retake sovereign Russian land. That's how badly their military is beat up and their capabilities are currently diminished. And so this is a big deal. And as you said, this is something we need to keep our eye on. And the nuclear portion of this will become more and more important into the future.
General, do you think that if Russia could do this again, knowing it would take not 3 weeks or 3 days, but 3 years with this type of damage, they'd do it?
Brian, I do. I mean, let's look at the track record. 08, they amassed their army, marched across an international border, and invaded Georgia and still occupied 20% of Georgia. Then it comes up to the winter of 13 and 14 when they first went into Crimea and then the Donbass. Two peace deals, Minsk 1 and Minsk 2, Russia blew them up and kept attacking and were killing people on that line all the way through the interim to their massive invasion, as you know, in 22. So Russia has demonstrated a pattern of attack. They are bent on rearranging the security infrastructure of Eastern Europe. I think, Brian, you've read the two documents that Putin gave us before this last three-year portion of this war. And in those documents, he essentially laid out the requirements and the structure of a new international security arrangement in Eastern Europe. And it was essentially rebuilding the Warsaw Pact with all the buffer nations and getting NATO and the United States out of those buffer nations so that Russia could hold sway in them like they did before. Russia has demonstrated a pattern. And until we break that pattern, we should expect more of the same.
Right. But they've been humiliated and exposed as a subpar military force. They have great numbers, but care nothing about them. General Breedlove, always great. Thanks so much.
Great to talk to you, Brian.
You got it. Back in a moment. And bottom of the hour, Mark Dubowitz, the CEO of Defense of Democracies, will talk about that new emerging evil alliance.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Even if you think it's a bit overhyped, AI is suddenly everywhere, from self-driving cars to molecular medicine to business efficiency. And if it's not in your industry yet, it's coming fast. But AI needs a lot of speed and computing power, so how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? Time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. Or OCI. OCI is a blazing fast and secure platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, plus all of your AI and machine learning workloads. OCI costs 50% less for compute and 80% less for networking. So you're saving a pile of money. Thousands of businesses have already upgraded to OCI, including Vodafone, Thomson Reuters, and Suno AI. Right now, Oracle is offering to cut your current bill, your current cloud bill, in half if you move to OCI. For new U.S. customers with minimal financial commitment, and the offer ends March 31st. See if your company qualifies for this special offer at oracle.com/Cain. That's oracle.com/CAIN.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Many American small business owners say they are concerned that these tariffs are going to hurt them. What's your message to them?
They're going to be so much richer than they are right now.
So that's the President of the United States talking about the tariffs, but the market's up 213 points. Why? I think a lot has to do with the word last night that Senator Schumer has acquiesced and will not stand in the way of any Democrat who wants to pass the continuing resolution with some slight additions, which is border money and defense money. And for Schumer to give in, it's got to be tough for him, but this is the right move. And I don't think Republicans should be spiking the ball, going caved and acquiesced and Trump wins. Enough. It's very important you act with decorum when you win, so people don't fear ever compromising again. Now, Schumer doesn't want the president and Elon Musk to go to town on deciding what to fund and not fund. And he doesn't have the votes. And everybody with a brain in their head will know the Democrats will be responsible. See, these House members have no sense of responsibility. They want to send a message and they're angry at Trump. Senate side does not have that luxury. Mark Dubowitz next.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
He's immediately concerned with that the 30-day ceasefire will favor the Ukrainians because they'll be able to rearm and reposition in the Kursk area, which is the part of Russia that Ukraine has been occupying for almost 7 months, which is quite stunning in itself. That hasn't happened since World War II. Russia is close to taking that and driving the Ukrainians out of it, and I think he's going to delay this until that is accomplished. We got to get into the details of this. We always knew that the Russians are going to fight hard. They're hardline bargainers for sure. He's talking nice with President Trump, as is President Trump to Putin. But we got some tough negotiations going forward.
And you need that international force. If the fact is the hard part's done, Britain and France said, yeah, we'll put troops in. That's got to be the difference from 2016. They're not going to breach again in 6 years after they reload because they'll have to run into a NATO force. But the Russians say there's no go there. Mark Dubowitz is with us now, CEO of Defensive Democracies. He's got a new podcast, The Iranian Breakdown. We'll get to Iran and the modern history of Iran and the people's current plight for freedom. Mark, first off, on this, fast-moving talks, obviously no one's agreed yet. No one expected them to agree yet. But where do you think this process is from what we've learned now about what the Russian stance is on what they agreed on in Jeddah?
Well, look, I mean, we've got the Ukrainians who've agreed that they will embark on serious peace talks. You've got the Russians who are, you know, Putin's playing that usual game where he doesn't say no, but it's sort of yes, but, yes, but. And the yes, but is I want all concessions. I want to win. I want to retain Ukrainian land. I want to make sure that Ukraine is never part of NATO or part of the EU for that matter.
Zelensky said, I want all our land back. You took it illegally. The invasion wasn't right. But what's practical? When do we get to the practical side? Have you not seen that with Putin ever?
Well, I certainly haven't seen that yet, and I think it's got to be that President Trump, and I think he's doing that, has got to say to Vladimir Putin, look, you come to the table, we negotiate, or I'm going to start amping up the sanctions pressure, and I'm going to give the Ukrainian military what President Biden didn't give them so that they can inflict even more serious blows on the Russian military. Putin's got to understand he can get a lot of concessions at the negotiating table, but he can't get everything.
You know, one thing is, I think the language is interesting. I'd like to thank President Trump for getting involved. And he said, partners, use the term partners. That matters, doesn't it? I mean, I don't like Vladimir Putin. I think he's the Hitler of our generation. But if you're looking to move forward, you use those words.
Yeah, but listen, Putin's a skilled diplomat. He's been around the block many times. He understands also how to appeal to President Trump, and he understands how to win at the negotiating table, even though he's been losing on the battlefield for a number of years against, I think, brave Ukrainian soldiers, but
hundreds of thousands.
This
has been a humiliation for him, don't you think? Or is he incapable of understanding how bad his people proportionally are doing?
Look, unfortunately, Brian, I mean, the Russians have you know, the way they win militarily, that they've done this over centuries, is they just throw more and more and more young bodies at the fight in a grinding war of attrition. And he knows at the end of the day, he's got more people to throw into the fight than Zelensky does. So he will continue to grind his people, both economically, militarily, and huge cost of
lives.
But
the bigger army doesn't always win.
Not always win, absolutely. And look, the Ukrainians have fought bravely. And I think from a U.S. perspective, I mean, we have to understand, we have spent 3.5 cents on the dollar of our military budget to take out a significant part of our second most dangerous enemy without one American troop on the ground, without one American life being lost. I mean, that is got to be the model for the 21st century, where our allies fight and die in their own defense against our enemies, against this axis of aggressors that is aligned against us.
So the president put this out a couple of days ago. I can do things financially to the Russians that are very, very, very bad for them. And to kind of say, you better look sincere when asked, are they going to sincerely try to bring peace? And then General Keane thought that this is an underreported portion of what Trump did, cut 18.
On March the 12th, the Trump team has removed the exemptions that were permitting the EU and others to sell oil, to buy Russian oil. And that is absolutely significant. This has been quietly done, but Putin certainly is aware of that. And it just goes to show you that the Trump team is going to play tough with Putin and at the same time talk nice to him publicly.
You were nodding.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. General Keane's got it. I mean, there were these exemptions that allowed the Russians to sell oil to the Europeans. And of course, I mean, Russia is a one commodity country, right? All they got is oil. So this has allowed them to stay afloat economically, despite the significant sanctions that were imposed on them. So I think this is a great move by President Trump. So that's right. Talk nice publicly, but coercive diplomacy is about coercion. And the United States needs to have leverage against one of the most wily and deadly dictators on the planet.
Today, and we'll see what happens, because Vladimir Putin did speak to President Trump yesterday, and they're going to speak again today. And we'll see where this goes. Is this a ceasefire? One thing that the Putin wants is what happens in Kursk? And he said, do they stay? Because that's a portion of Moscow. And then Trump this morning said right now the Ukrainian forces are surrounded in Kursk. And that he personally told Vladimir Putin, let him go. So if he means let him go, does that mean get out of the country? That would be the one bargaining chip that he had. So it's going to be complex. But if his goal, president's goal, is to stop the fighting, do you have a problem when he says enough killing, enough fighting? You study war. Do you think that we all, no one wants to die in war. But do you think we should be using that language?
Look, I think President Trump's right. I mean, it's been a grinding war. There have been hundreds of thousands of casualties, and the war has to be brought to an end. But, you know, we also have to recognize who is our ally and who is our adversary. And we have to make sure that we back our allies. If we don't back the Ukrainians, then we're not going to back the Israelis or the Taiwanese or the Koreans. And at some point, when we send a message around the world that we don't have your back. You know, the United States should always be, we're no greater friend and we're no worse adversary. Right. I mean, you don't want us as an enemy, but you want us as a friend. I'd be cautious about sending the opposite message. And so I think we need to back the Ukrainians, but we need to bring this to a resolution, and we need to do so with coercion.
Today, we understand, or it was yesterday, depending on the time change, in Beijing, Iran, North Korea, China, and Russia are meeting about nuclear talks. I don't know if they're trying to talk Iran off a ledge, or they also had military exercises this week. How significant is this alliance? What's your read?
Well, the alliance is significant. I mean, there really is an axis of aggressors. It is China, Iran, North Korea, and Russia. They have aligned. They're cooperating militarily, politically, economically, diplomatically against the United States, against our allies, against our interests. Right? We have to recognize that there is this axis out there. And then the question is, what do we do with members of the axis? So maybe on Russia, maybe the Trump administration can successfully flip the Russians against the Chinese and Iranians. Maybe. I'm skeptical. Maybe it's worth a try.
I'm more than skeptical.
Right. I think we should be. But that's what they're going to try to do. With the Chinese, this is a multi-generational struggle. We need to counter the Chinese Communist Party, particularly in the Indo-Pacific. The North Koreans already have nuclear weapons and ICBMs. It's a problem from hell. All we can do is make sure they don't invade Seoul and take over South Korea. But I think actually the Iranians are the weakest element of the axis. I think there we have an opportunity to do something significant. The Israelis have inflicted massive blows against the Iranian axis over the past 12 months. I think we need to back the Israelis, but we also have to understand Iran is poised to develop nuclear weapons. We need to have a plan diplomatically and militarily.
So right now, when you talk about, we have a window open, because if the reporting's true, and I would believe you, Mark, because with the Defense of Democracy, you've got best intelligence, but they did some damage to the missile defense system, the S-400 missile defense system, and I also did some damage to the nuclear program. So are either of those things true, and is it still the case right now?
Oh, yeah, the Israelis inflicted significant damage. I mean, they took out all of Iran's strategic air defenses. They reduced their ballistic missile production capability by like 93%. I mean, the skies are open. The Ayatollah is naked. And
no Syria?
And right, Assad's gone down. Hezbollah has been severely degraded. Hamas has been effectively destroyed as a military organization. The Israelis have done all of this in a year and a half. Again, if we have an ally willing to fight and die in our own defense against the common enemy, right, that's the model we want. And I think the Israelis are well poised to take out the rest of Iran's nuclear program. But President Trump's going to try to do it diplomatically. He sent a letter to Ali Khamenei, the Supreme Leader. Well, we'll see what happens. Khamenei came back and said, in the sense Khamenei said, no, we're not interested. But he needs to understand, the Supreme Leader needs to understand, that we either dismantle his nuclear program peacefully or President Trump's going to green light the Israelis to take it out militarily?
You know, people have told me too, in 40 years, we've never had been this close to being able to take down to size our enemy in the region, who is an enemy in the region, to all the people that we're allied to, whether it's UAE or Saudi Arabia or Jordan. No one likes them. Turkey, I guess, perhaps, which is a dicey nation. So do we let that window pass in terms of promise about the of a year of talks where they do certain things to maybe de-emphasize their nuclear program?
Yeah, well, that's the game that the regime is going to play with us. They're going to try rope-a-dope President Trump the way they've rope-a-doped multiple U.S. presidents, extend the diplomacy, kick the can down the road, do some kind of deal like Obama did in 2015, hundreds of billions of dollars of sanctions relief. Terrible deal.
Would have expired by now.
Would have expired. Exactly right. And, you know, you'd have Iran today with a internationally recognized, quote, legitimate nuclear weapons program and about $1 trillion in sanctions relief. President Trump is smart enough not to do that. President Trump understands he needs to dismantle the program. He doesn't want to do the Obama deal of 2015.
We don't want an alliance where Russia says an attack on one is an attack on all. Because if Israel goes ahead and takes out that program, Russia is going to be treaty obligated to do what we're doing in NATO. What would stop that? They could mount it today. Would that change our posture?
Well, it might be those threats, but they may be hollow threats. But at the end of the day, I don't think the Russians
would ignore it.
I don't think Russians want to go to war to defend an Iranian nuclear weapons program. I don't think the Chinese either. I think at the end of the day, what we need to be skeptical of is this idea that Russia is going to be on our side negotiating with the Iranians. The Russians in 2015 were Iran's lawyer.
That's the most ridiculous statement ever.
Right.
Because they offered that. Vladimir Putin says, hey, why don't I talk to Iran for you?
Right. Yeah. Right. They did that in 2015, and the Russians were on the Iranian side of the table, and they negotiated a great deal for Iran, not for the United States. I'm skeptical that you will get the Russians to be on our side with respect to Iran. The partnership is deep. The military ties are very close. The Iranians are providing drones and missiles to Russians to kill Ukrainians.
That was a game changer.
They
were running out of equipment.
That's right. That's right. And in terms of that, you know, and then the North Koreans were providing soldiers to the Russians.
Which is crazy.
To fight
North
the Ukrainians.
Koreans fighting against the Ukrainians. By the way, terrible fighters. I really know what they're basically cannon fodder too, correct?
That's right.
What do you think the South Koreans take away from that?
Well, I think they take away, you know, a few things. One is, are we going to be protected from the United States? Is the United States going to extend its military and nuclear umbrella over us? We have that theoretically. But if I were South Korea today, and frankly, if I were Taiwan today, Germany today, Ukraine today, I'd be thinking, I need my own nuclear weapons capability. My biggest fear is that if Iran gets nuclear weapons capability, the rest of these countries will develop their own nuclear weapons capability. We'll have nuclear proliferation through the Indo-Pacific, the Middle East, and Europe. And that's going to be a really dangerous world.
But guess who doesn't want that? China. China doesn't want that. So how do you use that to maybe China acquiesce? For example, if South Korea and Japan get nuclear weapons, what are they going to do?
No, that's exactly right.
That'll be a non-starter for them, just like we believe it's a non-starter of North Korea, but we let North Korea get weapons.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that's got to be the threat to these countries, to China, to Russia, and to the Iranians. And at the end of the day, your adversaries are going to end up with nuclear weapons, right? And so you've got to stop proliferation. You've got to work with us. Maybe that's the only chance.
And here's the danger that we have. It's our capabilities in reality right now. In honest testimony from the Air Force Deputy Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Adrian Spain, this week, Cut 25.
It is also a fact that today's airmen will do so with the oldest airplanes, the smallest force, and with fewer monthly flying hours than at any point in our history. Airmen have and always will get the job done, but today they do so at elevated risk. Meanwhile, China's military forces are expanding and modernizing. Their nuclear modernization, long-range missile proliferation, and recent test flights of 2 6th-gen aircraft is simply further evidence of the elevated threat in this strategic environment.
Want to challenge anything he said?
I don't. And I think he's exactly right. I mean, you know, it's one thing for us to go out to our allies and say you got to spend more militarily. It's exactly right. President Trump is saying that, and he's getting results. It's another thing is the Pentagon also needs to spend wisely, efficiently, effectively. But we can't be going into this new reality in the 21st century with the smallest Air Force, the smallest Navy, and fighting men who don't have the equipment in order to protect themselves.
So the people driving in their car right now listening to us say, wait a second, how much more money do we have to give them? We give them $800 billion a year. It's the thing. It's the largest expenditures. For some reason, Republicans are the only ones who want to spend for, and that's a give and take with Democrats. I don't know how that happened. But we're almost giving them $1 trillion. Like, how much more money? Now, in percentage to the GDP, we could do more. But they, don't you think they should be doing more with the money they have?
Well, listen, absolutely. I mean, I think it's exactly right what Elon Musk is doing with Doge, is going in there and saying, at the end of the day, we have to spend less to produce better results. But going in with a chainsaw in the Pentagon and just gutting the Pentagon is not the right thing
education.
To do. Well, we need to go in there with a scalpel, right? We need to figure out, and Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, is doing this with his team. How are we spending the money? How can we do it more effectively? Do we need these massive platforms that are multi-year, multi-hundred-billion-dollar platforms? Or can we be using next-generation drones, next-generation systems that are more versatile, more cost-effective, but equally deadly against our enemies, right? And I think there are companies out there right now who are not the sort of standard defense contractors, but now innovative defense contractors coming out of Silicon Valley, you know, who are developing this kind of technology.
And I'll let you go after this. Silicon Valley was not cooperating 10 years ago.
Correct.
Now they're all in.
They're all in.
That's awesome.
Yep. Yep. If we can, listen, we can bring Silicon Valley innovation to protect our warfighters. And you're exactly right. For decades, they weren't all in ideologically. That's changing, Brian. And I think if we can bring their innovation and effectiveness, we will be the most deadly, most efficient military on Earth. And we need to do that for the 21st century.
Mark Dubowitz, CEO of Defense of Democracies. Thanks for coming in studio. Great to see you.
Yeah, wonderful, Brian. Thank you.
Back in a moment.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Are your ulcerative colitis symptoms proving difficult to manage? Tremfya guselkumab can help you manage the cycle of UC symptoms. At 1 year, many patients taking Tremfya achieved clinical remission, and some patients also achieved endoscopic remission. Individual results may vary. Tremfya is a prescription medicine used to treat adults with moderately to severely active ulcerative colitis. Serious allergic reactions and increased risk of infections may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and TB. Tell your doctor if you have an infection, flu-like symptoms, or if you need a vaccine. Ask your doctor if Tremfya can help you manage the cycle of UC symptoms. Call 1-800-526-7736 to learn more or visit TremfyaRadio.com.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
President Trump and Republican leaders would like nothing more than to pull us into the mud of a protracted government shutdown. For Donald Trump, a shutdown would be a gift. It would be the best distraction he could ask for from his awful agenda.
I just love that word, awful agenda. Yeah, awful agenda, trying to decrease regulation, trying to get rid of the green energy that's all a scam and moneymaker for people like Stacey Abrams looking to cash in, like to build up defense. He like to give people additional opportunities, turn the country into a meritocracy. What an awful agenda. Stop the political correctness and DEI that hamstrung a nation and made us hate America. How about the pro-American philosophy? You might not like the tariffs, and that's a worthy debate. But to think his objective isn't to bring industry home, which used to be the agenda of Democrats, is unbelievable. So Chuck Schumer did the right thing yesterday. He backed down because he had no cards, if I could use Donald Trump's words. He says they can't do a shutdown. He said he told his caucus there's no off-ramp. The total off-ramp of a shutdown, how you would stop a shutdown, is totally determined by the Republican House and Senate. The Republican House delivered the continuing resolution. People are incensed. AOC on the sending signals said this. I hope Democrats understand there is nothing clever about setting up a fake failed 30-day CR first to turn around and vote for cloture on the GOP spending bill. Really? Okay, what about other people? What are they saying? How about Steve Cohen? I don't know where Chuck Schumer is coming from. It doesn't look good for a leader. How about Jim McGovern? Extremely disappointment. Another Democrat, Jared Huffman. It's a gut punch. It's a gut punch to not close down the government, realize you lost the majority in the House, and you have a substantial deficit in the Senate and are about to lose more, and we're about to be blamed for a government shutdown, which hurts everybody. You had no cards. You did the right thing. Stand up and be proud and say, well, I got to get the majority back if I'm a Democrat. But this is just loser, anger, loser. Brian Kilmeade.
great days start with great underwear, and Tommy John makes the greatest. With Tommy John, you make each day better than the last. And with over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys everywhere love their Tommy John. Plus, you're fully covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Grab 25% off your first order now at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. Save 25% at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade coming here from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where there's a lot of action here anyway. But last night in 24 hours, get this, four people were hit by subway trains. Violence, four deaths in 24 hours in New York City and subways. Right. It's such a safe city. Number two is from the riots that took place at Trump Tower in the vestibule because there are pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas, which is insanity. The Democrats are actually sticking up for this 31-year-old student still living in dorms from Syria who is leading and organizing all these insurrectionist anti-Semitic protests, taking over of buildings where it got him in Louisiana, about to deport him, and there people are protesting for him. Anybody protesting should be thrown out of the country. That's one. And then number two in New York City, that is we're going to have the St. Patrick's Day Parade will be the number one parade in the country. So that'll be fun. That's coming up on Monday. Joining us this hour, Brian Brenberg, co-host of The Big Money Show. Oh, he's not going to be there. Okay. And then Sebastian Lai will be with us, son of Jimmy Lai, the Hong Kong businessman and the Apple Daily publisher and pro-democracy advocate. He's currently on trial as his dad in Hong Kong for violating the communist China's backed national security law. So his son is here, so people don't forget about Jimmy, who's got so many allies with the Wall Street Journal, people like General Keane, because he's a benevolent, self-made multi-billionaire who would not abandon his newspaper and has actually paid the price with his freedom. So 1-866-408-7669. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We're here in the name of peace, and we're asking for Mahmoud to be released. He was taken illegally by the ICE department. He was kidnapped by the United States government.
There it goes, and you're hearing it. Colombia crackdown. Anti-American pro-Hamas protesters take over Trump Tower. Trump's America will not allow this to happen. And Colombia cracking down on people that took over their buildings last year because they've already lost $400 million for letting anti-Semitism flourish on their campus.
Number two.
I do have leverage, but I don't want to talk about leverage now, because right now we're talking to him, and based on the statements he made today, they were pretty positive, I think. So I don't want to talk about that. I hope Russia's going to make the deal, too.
That is President Trump on Vladimir Putin getting the ceasefire parameters and saying positive things, but says there's a lot more talking to do. Vladimir Putin spoke to Donald Trump yesterday. We'll talk about where this is going.
Number one.
If we enter a shutdown, House and Senate Republicans would pursue a strategy of bringing bills to the floor to reopen only their favorite departments and agencies.
There you go. Chuck backs down a no government shutdown thanks to House Republicans really sticking together and sticking it to the Senate, who has not been off for 15 weeks. And they were going to have to stay in town, I guess, and try to extend this CR. But no one was playing ball on the right. They were not negotiating. Schumer had no cards to play, but his Democratic colleagues are incensed because of it. I'm talking to everybody. They're talking about primarying Chuck Schumer. I mean, as mad as people were with Mitch McConnell, they were saying you might not be a leader, but primarying Chuck Schumer, he really had no cards to play. I give him credit for doing that. But AOC, who has no idea about leadership, cut six.
How will House Democrats and Senate Democrats work together now if there is such a sense of betrayal?
I think that creates a real challenge. And that in and of itself, I think, is part of what makes the leadership of this moment so crucial. Because this is a decision about trust. It is a decision about trust and cooperation. Because there will be a day where The Senate will need the House to move on something. And if there is an erosion of trust and a breach of trust, such as what is being considered right now, it will make cooperation difficult.
Who is she talking to? What she's saying is Hakeem Jeffries made sure that only one person, Jared Golden, voted for the continuing resolution, which never should have been in Trump's lap. Think about it. He's had the job 7 weeks. He's supposed to come up with a budget. It never should have been left there, but it was and it is. So now they have funding the government for 7 months. And because the Hakeem Jeffries decided not to give Speaker Johnson any votes and the Democrats decided to okay it, that means they have a breach of trust. I don't want to referee that family fight, but she has not a leg to stand on. If she ever actually, just like Tom Massie, if they actually led anything instead of taking grandstanding, they would never have these actions. They do not know what it's like. The Freedom Caucus used to be like that, but now they stand for things, but they also want to get things done. So Senator Pete Ricketts weighed in last night on the Schumer, what would have been the Schumer shutdown. Cut eight.
Well, obviously, I was not in that Democrat meeting. I didn't get invited. But again, you're just pointing out the hypocrisy of the Schumer shutdown. He had 11 of our 12 appropriations bills come out of committee last year. He did not bring a single one up to vote. In fact, over the last 4 years of the Biden administration, Schumer brought up exactly three of the potential 48 bills that would have been out there to be able to do it. So he had the opportunity to be able to get this budget passed. He ignored it. He wanted to write it. And now that Republicans are in charge, all of a sudden he's got second thoughts about this. It's just galling.
It is. And that's Pete Ricketts. Now he has second thoughts. If you had passed your appropriations bill and put your budget forward and maybe the numbers or they didn't match with the House, I'd have some sympathy for you. But you don't do your job. If you don't go through the normal budget process, you're not doing your job. And that's what Speaker Johnson told us on Fox and Friends, that they're going to do this time for September. The budget's going to get to work. Democrats and Republicans, ideally working together, hopefully they will. And they put together budgets that they're proud of in the committees in which they become experts in. And then they put it together in one big bill. The speaker looks at it and says, here's your offer, Mr. President, as it relates to what you gave me this spring. And then the Senate does something similar and they work it out. And maybe there's some compromise there. But the omnibus and the continuing resolutions, it's no one's agenda. It's just stop gapping everything. And we have I have a huge problem with that. But just to give you an idea how bad it is, Senator Kristen Gillibrand of New York was so incensed, she was screaming so loud, our reporters and other reporters heard her screaming that we have to pass this resolution because it will just give Donald Trump more power to fund the programs he wants and cut how he seems suitable, which would be their greatest fear. Among people upset, one lawmaker saying, I'm writing a check to support AOC for senior House Democrat to run for the Senate against Chuck Schumer. Really? Nice try. Congressman Steve Cohen, I don't know where Schumer's coming from. Jay Appel, the former chair of the Progressive Caucus, warned the vote is about more than just spending. If we give into this, we're going to give into a whole bunch of other things. Jim McGovern, it's a gut punch. Grow up. My goodness. When are you just going to look around and understand you have no choice? So the other big story that's taking place of people talking about the Russia-Ukraine ceasefire talks. Jeddah, our delegation left with Ukrainians agreeing on the parameters for a ceasefire. They have now arrived in Moscow. Steve Witkoff is meeting with Vladimir Putin. And in Moscow, calling back to the White House, and they're trying to get something done. Vladimir Putin calling back, too. They have obscene demands that they're not going to get. There's going to be international troops there. The president can't give on that. There's not going to be any limitation on troops for Ukraine. They have a million-man army. It's going to stay that way. Not going to go down to 86,000. They're not going to have immediate elections because Moscow wants them to. But in terms of the actual ceasefire fighting, there's no way they're going to go back to 2016 deal when you know in 4 or 5 years they're going to rearm and invade again. I thought it was a great point brought up a previous guest today when we had the Defense of Democracy, Mark Dubowitz, in here. And he said, on average, we spend 3 cents on the dollar to have our chief adversary lose 800,000 people out of their army. That's a pretty good investment. It really is. I know it's callous, but it is. So the other thing that happened on Tuesday is China, Iran, Russia, and North Korea, I think, we're doing military maneuvers right in a waterway we would need to move through oil and gas, okay? They were showing everybody we have an alliance, and they're meeting today about a nuclear program. The other way that China tries to spread their influences by going to developing nations with raw materials and natural resources and saying, hey, you guys need bridges, you need roads, you need tunnels, you need infrastructure, water projects, I'll do that. Just give me the rare earth. Or let me build a military base. It's called the Belt and Road Program, and it goes through Africa, South America, now the Caribbean. It is insidious. It's created just to counter America's influence around the world. So how do I factor that all together? As we see these Ivy League institutions give birth to so much anti-American, anti-Israel students and demonstrations, which is costing them millions, if not billions, you wonder, where are they learning this? Why do they think it's okay? Why is the faculty seemingly in support? Well, let me bring you to this soundbite. It's Jeffrey Sachs. He's a Columbia professor and UN analyst. He appeared on Chinese TV. Listen to what he says about this insidious Belt and Road program. And let me just go further to tell you what it's about. So if you are a developing nation in the Congo, let's say, or Zaire, and you decide to take and sign on to the Belt and Road program, or like Panama, what happens is invariably they build your airport, they build your tunnel, they redo your roads, and then they say, okay, can you pay us? And invariably, this often corrupt, bootstrapped nation goes, no, I don't have the money to pay. They go, okay, we're going to take ownership of it, and then we're going to need your rare earth, and we're probably not going to be paying for it. It's an insidious deal with the devil. So listen to Jeffrey Sachs speak on Chinese TV praising this program. Cut 40.
I think it's a phenomenally positive and important initiative. That's one of the reasons I can say only semi-facetiously that the United States badmouths it all the time, because it's very good and very important. It's helping to finance the infrastructure and the connectivity of the world economy. And it is a source of exports by China to the rest of the world, a source of loans and now increasingly equity capital, meaning foreign direct investment by Chinese companies that are producing in partner countries as well. Now, it's created a so-called challenge of debt repayments by recipient countries, and that has been called a debt trap by the United States and so forth. This is not at all true. The main point is China should be providing financing to the emerging economies. They can repay these loans. The only change I would make in the Belt and Road program, in addition to expanding it, would be to lengthen the maturity of the loans that are given from roughly 10-year finance to 20 or 25-year finance, because developing countries need 20 or 25 years to reap the benefits in terms of increased output that then repays the loans. But aside from that footnote of a lengthening maturity, expand BRI. This is the way that the whole world gets interconnected with advanced 21st century green and digital technologies.
How about subjugated to Chinese will? Oh, I want to lengthen the loan. You know what you read between the lines? You know what the lengthen the loan means? Nobody's able to make the payments. You know what happens? Just like what happens when you can't afford your card payments. They repossess it. They take it. They own it because you aren't able to make your payments. I gave you a loan. You said you'd pay it back. You can't, so I have it. It's my airport. It's my military base. It's my rare earth. I'll keep it now. And this guy, a Columbia professor, praising that program, by the way, sarcastically saying America, since it's so effective, criticize it as if he's forgetting that he's an American. And by the way, you might say, well, he's just a liberal, so he doesn't like Trump. What does that do with Trump? I mean, this Belt and Road program took root in the Obama years and then went through Trump, through Biden. And this guy just loves it. So why don't we just give China all of Central and South America? Now, your criticism should be America should have a counter program, only doing it honestly and with integrity. And you could talk about what it's done, but how dare you praise it? But if you wonder where that anti-American flavor comes from, Jeffrey Sachs, a Columbia professor I hope your kids never have, and UN analyst, by the way, another anti-American in New York City, who would have thought? Let you know. I'll come back. I'll take your calls, 1-866-408-7669. Also, there is some good stories with coming out of Gaza, so I'll let you know what it is when we come back.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Upgrade your business with Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. Shop Pay boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning fewer carts going abandoned and more sales going cha-ching. So if you're into growing your business, get a commerce platform that's ready to sell wherever your customers are. Visit Shopify.com to upgrade your selling today.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I think that the big deal for the market is just the not knowing what's next and what the target is necessarily going to be, and also not knowing where this stops. Because if we ratchet up tariffs, they retaliate, we go higher, then what?
Well, look, sir, it could go the other way, too. Look, that's the nature of these reciprocal tariffs. That all President Trump is asking is for countries to take theirs off. So we have identified some strategic industries, the steel, aluminum, likely autos, but everything else is up for grabs, and that's going to be a decision that's made by our trading partners.
So that's the Treasury Secretary, good friend of the show, Scott Bessent, talking about the tariffs that went on that spooked the market this week. But he's trying to say we're rebalancing the economy. We're hitting tariffs back and forth. I think today it was liquor going back and forth yesterday, which making a big deal. The president said, I'm going to put tariffs on liquor coming from EU nations at 200%. Now, that'll affect the little guy in the short term. And when you do aluminum, it'll help hurt the Midwest in the short term. But their hope is to rebalance it and bring production back here. The incentive's so great to make aluminum here, sell your cars here, make those cars here, that you're going to want to bring it here. And in the meantime, the market doesn't like the uncertainty. They're not happy with it. And I think a lot of people love the chaos of it. How about this? I got this email from Scott. Scott writes, the left loves the chaos. He goes, no one seems to be talking about this. The left is trying to create as much chaos as possible. The media loves it. People voted for Biden in 2020 to get away from the chaos. Remember, the left and the media is doing it all over again. And that's what they're talking about, televising these town halls or the lack of town halls from Republicans. They're actually sending people in who are creating havoc so they get the optics of a Republican lawmaker sitting there being yelled at in a district they won by 20 points to show that people aren't happy with Trump's economy. Right now, according to a poll, 56% don't like the direction of the economy. But that could change quickly. For example, the market's up 200 points right now as I speak. A lot of it has to do with they're not going to have a shutdown. And if you don't have a shutdown, that's going to make the market better because we're not going to be on austerity. I think that matters. So we'll see what the president's going to do. A first week in April, nothing's changing, reciprocal tariffs. At which time, I think it's going to be like Jerry Maguire after he gets fired from his agency. We're going to have a million people calling up saying, India, 40% on American cars. Well, we're going to put 40% on anything that's coming from you guys. Well, how do we drop that? Let's drop it to 20. Gun. Hang up. UK is going to call. What are we going to do about the garments that we've been sending over? Well, they're going to be wrapped up. Well, how do we get it down equally? Let's break it down to 5. Let's do it. Boom. Hang up. All these nations are going to be weighing in, trying to reconfigure relationships. Wall Street doesn't love that. They don't know exactly what to do with that. And the president not coming out strongly and being saying, no, there's no recession, that began to spook the markets in then the beginning of the week. I think things will settle down, though. I'll tell you one thing for sure. I know this firsthand. The president's anything but panicking.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
When Jimmy Lai was marched out of Apple Daily's offices, it marked the end of an era for Hong Kong. The billionaire newspaper owner had been a key figure in the umbrella movement, the protests for freedom and democracy against China's increasingly authoritarian control of the territory. It made him a celebrity, even meeting key American leaders. But it also made him a target. And after the passage of Hong Kong's controversial national security law, he was one of hundreds of activists arrested and charged with collusion with foreign powers. Now languishing in jail as his trial continues, his friends and allies have not given up the hope that one day Jimmy Lai might walk free.
And that is certainly the hope of his son, Sebastian Lai, who's in studio with me right now. Jimmy Lai is a well-known international businessman, self-made success story. And when the crackdown came in Hong Kong, of all freedoms, he stood strong rather than, as you just told me, Sebastian, he had a British passport. He could have easily gotten out with his wealth.
Yeah, he could have left at any point, but he knew that the right thing to do was stand by his belief and stand by his people, defend his people when they needed him the most.
And what happened? They picked him up. He knew he was going to be arrested. He's running a newspaper.
Exactly.
And they said, stop it. And he said, no.
Well, it's actually incredible. So they arrested him, arrested a few of his colleagues, and then they sent 200 police officers to raid the Apple Daily, the newspaper, which was the biggest newspaper in Hong Kong. And when the journalists refused to close, they then sent another 500 people, froze its bank accounts, and shut down the newspaper.
And what did they do with your dad?
My father has been in prison since the end of 2020 when he was arrested. Now, the conditions are horrific. He's being kept in solitary confinement. He turns 78 this year, and he will be on his fifth year this year of solitary confinement.
Wow.
Not receiving, he doesn't get natural light. It's blocked off. And because in these very incredibly trying situations, you can imagine his faith is very important for him. They've also decided to deny him the Eucharist.
So, first off, let's take a step back. How did your dad make his wealth?
My father landed in Hong Kong as a child refugee when he was 12 from communist China. And so it's this beautiful story.
Run by England at the time, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Hong Kong was a British colony. And my father fell in love with the freedoms that you know, we all associate with, you know, rule of law, the free press. So he went from a manual laborer in a factory to eventually having his own factory, his own textile factory. And then he started this company called Giordano, which was a fashion brand. And that was one of the fastest growing and largest clothing brands in Asia. But then the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre happened.
Tiananmen Square.
Exactly, Tiananmen Square massacre, where many, as you know, many students were killed. And so my father... everybody in Hong Kong was incredibly shocked by that, but my father knew that he had to do something to defend the freedoms that gave him so much, the freedoms of Hong Kong. So he started his newspaper a few years after that, Apple Daily. And when he started it, everybody made fun of him because he's, you know, this fifth grade educated child laborer. They just very derogatory stuff like, go back to your factory, you know, you don't belong in this space. They made fun of him until Apple Daily became the largest newspaper in Hong Kong, and they couldn't laugh anymore. But more importantly, Apple Daily had a commitment to the truth. It had a commitment to democracy. And so it was this newspaper that, as you can imagine, pissed off a lot of very powerful people. But it was so important that the people of Hong Kong had this choice in the newsstand every day.
And he had protections by an agreement that was signed with the British that said... Well, one country, two systems.
Exactly. When in 1997, when Hong Kong went from the hands of the British government to back to the Chinese, there was one country, two systems for 50 years. So Hong Kong would still have all its freedoms. Would be able to elect its leader, and that would last until 2047. Obviously, we're in 2025, and those freedoms have been gone for the last 5 years.
Didn't China benefit from this financial engine of Hong Kong? And that is why they pretty much said, do your own thing. We're enjoying this revenue.
Yeah, exactly. So it's been tremendously – the sort of current situation in Hong Kong, the downfall since the passing of the national security law has been tremendously hurtful for both the economy of Hong Kong, but also – investments in China, because Hong Kong used to be a port, it used to be a financial center where you were protected by a legal system, you had the rule of law, and you could go live in Hong Kong and invest through Hong Kong to China.
Sebastian Lai is our guest. His dad's being held in solitary confinement. One of a worldwide respected businessman with contacts all throughout the West, especially throughout America. We have not seen him in 5 years. How hard has that been on you and your family and your brothers?
In some sense, the holiday season just passed, and you you think to yourself, actually, you know, my father making this decision, inadvertently, he decided not to spend that time with us. You know, he's 77. He should be enjoying the rest of his life with his grandchildren, taking them to school, you know, going for dinners, meeting his friends and whatnot. But he decided to stay in Hong Kong and defend his people, defend Why? His journalists. I think in my father's story, you have the story of a man who fell in love with freedom, who really fell in love with freedom. And if you think of a 12-year-old refugee, I mean, isn't this the best possible thing that could have happened? A man falls in love with freedom, becomes incredibly successful, and thinks to himself, actually, it doesn't really matter how much money I have. I need to protect these freedoms. Mm. And and then campaigns for democracy for the next 20-odd years. And when push comes to shove, when his people needed him, when people were coming after his people, he stayed and defended them. I mean, it's a tremendous story. So even though, you know, unfortunately, we're not going to get the time back, right? And he's not with us at the moment. He's still fighting, and I'm tremendously proud that he's my father.
Of course. I can understand that, too. You've been unable to talk to him. Somehow you get information that his health is suffering. Cause if you're in the prime of your life, he'll be suffering.
Yeah.
So do you think he regrets it?
No. So actually
he anticipate this type of terrible
prison
condition?
Well, so I think he always knew that it was a huge possibility of him getting arrested. He stayed in Hong Kong knowing that was definitely something that was going to happen. Recently, his national security law trial has been ongoing. He's been on the stand. So it was an opportunity.
You get a chance to see him.
So I can't go back to Hong Kong, so I can't see him. So it's not televised, but it's open court. So people can go in, and so you hear about his conditions. He's a lot skinnier. And it's a horrible scene. You can imagine 77-year-old on the stand, these three national security law judges just shouting at him. But he's
that how strong. Is that the system? They shout at you?
So that is not the usual system. That is not the usual system in a place that claims to have rule of law. But that is currently what Hong Kong is now. Three national security law judges, no jury, allegations.
No lawyer?
So he does get a Hong Kong defense team, but allegations of tortured witnesses. So it's a complete and utter show trial. And it's lasted more than a year now. And, you know, my father, obviously, his health has gotten much worse given what's happened to him. But is this tremendously... it's this tremendously emotional moment where you see that even though all of that, he's gone through all of that, he still holds true to his beliefs. He's still strong immensely and strong of faith. And he's still fighting. And it's incredible.
Do you think does President Trump know him?
So we've been incredibly grateful that the president mentioned that 100% he will free my father. He mentioned it in a radio show with Hugh Hewitt. And it's given our family a lot of hope because at this point it is about freeing him, but it's about saving his life. I don't know how much longer he has.
Did they know each other?
So my father has never had the
because he is a high, your dad's a high profile, well respected businessman and known for his character as well as his acumen.
Yeah. So unfortunately, he hasn't had the pleasure and the honor to meet President Trump. But I hope.
But they know of each other.
My father has always been incredibly supportive of the president, and I believe that the president knows of my father.
And we know there's going to be a meeting in April between it looks like President Xi and President Trump. Mm-hmm. So that could be the first one. I know it doesn't work on your behalf to say anything negative about President Xi. Mm-hmm. I get it. But in the big picture, he's been so much worse and so much more oppressive than people could imagine. Mm. I mean, people really equate him with Mao.
So, I mean, I think my father's case is a perfect opportunity of where it would be the easiest thing for them to just put him on a plane. It'll take them 3 hours. Put him on a plane and send him back to London, to the United States, and just be done with this problem. And if you can't even do that, then you know, that tells you a lot about the people.
Has your dad had organized support?
So we've been incredibly grateful by all the support that we've been getting. The United States was the first state to call for my father's release, followed by the European Union, Canada, Parliament and Senate passed unanimous consent motion. Australia recently called for his release. The United Kingdom called for his release. So we've been getting a lot of support. And by the Catholic By Catholics around the world.
He's Catholic.
He is Catholic. His faith is a guiding light in his life. It's also what, you know, one of the reasons why he is still so strong now that he's been in those horrible conditions in the last 4 years.
Sebastian Lai is here. His dad's imprisoned in Hong Kong for refusing to sell his newspaper, and I'm sure they're taking his wealth, right?
They've taken everything in Hong Kong. Apple Daily used to be a listed company, and they've torpedoed it. I mean, worse yet, they've arrested some of my father's colleagues,
right?
And frozen everything.
And what do you want people to know?
I want people to know about my father's story, about this man who has given everything he has for freedom and in the defense of his people, and it's a story of courage, of bravery, but also one of hope, and I hope they do what they can to help my father, but also if they are religious, please pray for my father.
And how hard has it been on you?
You know, it's one of those things where I worry every single night whether he's going to make it through the next day. But in the end of the day, it is hard, but I'm also inspired by his courage.
Mom's still alive?
Yes, my mother's still
alive. How's she handling it?
So, she decided to stay in Hong Kong and be there with my father.
Is she experiencing any type of surveillance? And
so fortunately, they have not arrested my mother. It's this incredibly brave woman who is there for my father every time. It's a beautiful story.
If people want to help, what do they do?
So they could go on to support jimmylai.com to follow the what's currently happening. They could write to their congressman. They could and speak out. Just tell my father's story. It's such a beautiful story.
It is, and it's LAI, jimmylai.com.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Great, Sebastian. Yeah. Great to meet you. Sorry you're going through this, but I get the sense, with all the respect your dad has garnered with these powerful people around the world throughout his entire life for this self-made story and being a great person, that there's going to be enough pressure that maybe I think that he'll get his freedom.
I hope so.
All right.
I pray so.
Thanks, Sebastian.
Thank you.
Back in a
moment.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Did you think President Biden was up to the job mentally?
You know, I'm going to be confessional here, Dana. I'm like so many other Democrats wanted to believe, and we were wrong, and we should have been more critical.
Do you think you were lied to?
I don't think I was lied to. I think it was magical thinking. We wanted to believe what we wanted to believe. I think, sure, not everyone will agree, I think he did some very good things as president. But it was clear that he was not the same person towards the end of the term.
So think about this. That is Mayor de Blasio halfway telling the truth. All you had to do is make a call. All these people are on his speed dial. He was not well respected, but he was well connected. He knew. And in 1 minute with Joe Biden, he knew he was out of it. Now he says we're all surprised, thinking magical thinking. The thing is, now we're getting all these books, and you know about Jake Tapper's book that he has coming out with the Axios guy. And now you have other people saying that, he was failed. We should have reported it. Other people are bringing it up. They'll write about it. Please don't let these people get away with it. In the end, the thing that people are going to remember, the worst thing that happened to Joe Biden is he did well at the midterms. It was the best thing to happen to Republicans, even though we didn't know it at the time as a country, because he didn't get routed. Lost the House, but just barely. Held the Senate. I think he might have lost a seat. People said, aha, even though I screwed up the pandemic, even after Afghanistan, America still likes the Democrats. And Donald Trump, as long as he's running and we could run against him, we are safe. But he was failing in 2021, not even appearing, doing interviews at the Super Bowl by 2023. Not in doing any type of press conference, unscripted situation. We know about is the ridiculous things he said, just yelling, Vladimir Putin's got to go, after his speech in Poland. Totally acting irresponsible, not finding his way off stage. And yet they kept him there. And don't tell me you didn't know how to get rid of him, because George Clooney, an actor, ended up getting rid of him. So that whole thing about with Democrats is unbelievable. A couple of things developed this week. Evidently, there's a story that Kamala Harris was obsessed with chair height. Did you hear about this? Obsessed with chair height on all her interviews. Want to make sure she was up high, whether she's with Stephen Colbert or doing an interview with with her vice presidential candidate, Tim Walz, which is a joke. It shows you how shallow she is. And let me ask some, where exactly is she? She is nowhere. And you know why she's nowhere? Because she has nothing to say. Reportedly, she's getting ready to run for governor. It's interesting. Run for governor. So a failed attorney general, a invisible vice president, a epically flawed candidate for president, now wants to run a state who's been run into the ground by Gavin Newsom. Gavin Newsom's trying to rehab his image by talking to Republicans and seeing reasonable. He has a state to run that's got their major city burned to the ground. Everyone talking about the red tape, the impossible to build, and the clearances they got to get, and the green obstacles that exist. And he's doing a podcast 4 of the last 5 days of this week. It's also revealed a few weeks ago that $6 billion is expected to cost Medi-Cal to pay for illegal immigrants' Medicare needs. Now, guess what? He doesn't have the money. So he's got to ask the federal government for the money. Do you think for a second the federal government is going to pay for that with Donald Trump in charge? Meanwhile, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear took a swipe at Gavin Newsom for hosting all these prominent Republican figures like Steve Bannon, who much to the horror of every Democrat, was able to say the 2020 election was fixed and thrown to Joe Biden. And evidently, Gavin Newsom just sat there. Beshear said Newsom shouldn't have opened up the platform with Steve Bannon. He's got the American First agenda. A lot of people are being very critical, as Charlie Kirk got him to admit, that having women, trans men playing women's sports is not to anyone's advantage. That was interesting. Not really overplayed, but interesting. Please, all I ask you is don't buy it that he's some reform guy, because he's not. At the same time, we understand, too, that the governor of New York is at the White House today to talk to President Trump about the whole congestion pricing. But Trump's got an agenda, too. Listen to this. Cut 38.
Well, we're working on one project. It should be very easy. It's a pipeline going through a small section of New York. New York's held it up for years, actually, for years. They've wanted to do it for years and years. And it will reduce the most expensive energy almost in the world is in New England.
So he's got to get rid of it. He says it costs about, you know, it'll save everybody about $2,500 a year in their heating. But they don't want it. Just the symbolism of a pipeline going through New York. Hopefully it'll change his mind.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hello and welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm Brian Kilmeade. I work 15 hours a day and I sleep for 35 seconds at a time. I have the sleep schedule of a cricket. Today in the news, I'm endorsing Kamala Harris. Brian Kilmeade here.
Yes, and that sounds so much like
newfound Democrat.
Are you AI? That is so much like me.
I am the AI Brian.
So,
teach me.
So listen, you have good thing. You have no radio experience, so you really were ill-equipped to help me out. So really, I mean, what is your background in radio? It's only been lasting since the 80s, right?
90s, early 90s.
90s, yeah. When did you peak?
91.
When did you peak? Or you still
91 and a half.
91 yeah. and a half. And that was it.
That was it.
No, but you're doing great on Gutfeld all week.
Oh, thanks, man.
You enjoying it?
Yeah, it's fun. It's a really fun show to do.
I mean, if you compare, do you ever flip around at night when you're not on?
I don't watch TV when I go home. I haven't even started White Lotus, and I love that show.
And you named your daughter after the movie, the series.
Yeah, Little Tiny Lotus.
Right.
Yeah.
So here's the thing.
You know, the series has only been on for a few years. She's 16.
But how do you stay so in touch with pop culture, mm-hmm. but yet you say stuff like, I don't watch TV?
I read the Daily Mail.
That did?
Yeah.
You're plugging yourself again.
Brian, yes. I'm a columnist for the Daily Mail, and I have a wonderful column coming out today about how horrible spring break is now and how awesome it was in the 90s.
Well, what makes it bad now? It just seems that they're doing the same thing. They just drink and go to the beach.
I wish they were. I wish they were drinking and going to the beach. There is a porn star named Bonnie Blue who's famous for plowing through 1,058 guys in one day. and she's going to Cancun, and she has promised to bed lesser endowed young men and pay off some of their tuition. So imagine having to go home to your mom and be like, Mom, guess what? I got a scholarship. It's like, honey, that's great. Was it from your grades or community service? No, I banged a hose hound in Cancun. Right.
And how you qualified. You can't really, you know, it gets better, Mom. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Your little baby carrot has a big
right. You know, I was thinking to myself, spring break or Russia, Ukraine? Which way to start? Any regrets?
See, you and I differ on Ukraine, which is okay.
You're going for the communists.
I hate commies. I really, really hate commies. I've always hated commies. I hate war.
Oh, everybody hates war.
I wish that were the case. But if you send a country tens of billions of dollars, you can extend their war indefinitely. And,
or just let them lose.
I don't know what losing is here. I think losing might be losing like millions of young men. So you have
absolutely
an entire generation of young women who are using sperm donors.
But I'll give you the best example possible.
You might just have to go to Cancun. That's
all full circle. I'll give you the best example. You could say, I hate fighting, but you walk in and someone just punches you in the face.
Yeah.
And there's no sense any cops coming. Mm-hmm. You got one choice.
Yeah.
You could sit in the fetal position or get up and fight.
Yeah.
And then when you start losing that fight, or let's say the fight starts evening out, you can't go, well, it's not my fault. Let's go for a ceasefire. I give Ukraine no blame, zero for this. Absolutely zero for this.
What about the United States? Do you give the United States any blame for what's happened between Ukraine and Russia?
No. For not giving them more arms early, because I think that if a more well-armed Ukraine, if they thought it was going to be a harder fight.
We disarmed them in the 90s.
Absolutely.
You could say that was a problematic turning point.
97.
Yeah.
They give up their nuclear weapons.
And we're like, we got you. Don't worry about this.
And you know who else got them? Russia also agreed.
Yeah.
They said, listen, we're friends now. We're allies. We're going to help become a democracy. If you give up your nuclear weapons, we'll watch your back. Yeah. And Ukraine goes, sounds good to me.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't work. Because then we have the Crimea capture, the Donbass capture, and 2016. They go, okay, we're not going to do it anymore. We're done.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we have 2022.
Three. Wasn't it 23? No, 22. You're right. It's
2022.
Been 3 years.
Was it? And Barack Obama's...
I was in Costa Rica when that happened.
I mean, if you go to rehab, Barack Obama saying, okay, you've been invaded. Crimea, you're going to have to give it back. He told Putin you're going to have to give it back. That went well. And then he said, I see you're in trouble. How would you like a sleeping bag and some MREs? Literally, that's all we gave them.
Mm-hmm.
NATO was... spending only three countries were spending the 2% they were supposed to be spending. And we did nothing once the ceasefire happened to make sure it didn't start again.
Okay, so let's say that we are arming them with offensive missile systems that they are now launching into Russia. So this is no longer a defensive position. They're now going on offense against Russia.
Sometimes your best defense is offense.
And sometimes the worst case scenario is letting veterans sleep in the street and letting Americans suffer while tens of billions of dollars go to a country that is engaging in a war and attrition where there is no winning scenario for them. I do believe, and I don't know if it was Howard Lutnick the other day, but someone laid out like, no, it wasn't Howard Lutnick. It was actually a pro-Ukrainian Brit who said what Trump is offering Ukraine right now is the best solution for them.
And that's where we're at. So let's move it forward. And if they're never invaded again and armed to fight again, and they've taken, it was explained to me by the Defense of Democracy, Mark Dubowitz, earlier in the show. So I'm not claiming to be this smart.
I mean, you're good at assimilating other people's information, which is in and of itself its own intelligence.
Wow, that really hurts. We spend 3 cents on every dollar.
Mm-hmm.
To take out our number one or number two enemy, 700,000 to 900,000 of their fighters in the world of security, that's a pretty good investment. If you had to in a fight that you never wanted and clearly didn't equip them to win, so we understand that Mike Waltz, Marco Rubio left Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, with a deal that Ukraine agreed to, and they said essentially. They don't want to say it out loud, but essentially the lines stay where they are, move up a little either way. I'm not sure what they're going to do with Kursk, which was in Russia, and in turn for a ceasefire. Ukraine, Vladimir Putin came back and thanked Donald Trump mm-hmm. for putting this together, said, and framework, I agree with it, but I got some problems. I want to make sure they don't have a million-man force. It's got to be 86,000. That's not good. We're going to make sure they have immediate elections. Well, if there was elections, Zelensky's got 67% approval. He'd win. Why are you calling for elections, Russia, in anywhere, ever, like you have real elections? And number three, they want to get more of the land. Not only the land that they have, they want land they haven't even captured.
Yeah.
So obviously negotiations are going to begin. But I was able to text to Trump today because I was interviewing General Keane and the General Secretary of NATO. And he said he feels optimistic. I got a call from someone in the room from Jeddah. Said he's cautiously optimistic. The fighting's en route to ending.
Okay, great. So we are where we were 3 years ago.
Right.
So we wasted tens of billions of dollars. And how many hundreds of thousands of people died?
Well, if we did not arm Ukraine,
Everybody,
all the deaths would have been Ukrainians. So
Soviet civilians or Russian, sorry. You know, that's the Romanian in me. Russian civilian deaths are okay. I don't think that's okay. I really don't.
If you start a war, all bets are off.
And I don't think, you know, this moral equivalence, like, well, you know, at least they're not Americans who are dying. It's like, I don't want Americans to die, but guess what?
Well,
I don't want Ukrainians to die.
That's
I don't want Russians to die.
But like I said, they punched Ukraine in the face for not having a stooge as their leader, Yankovic. Although you're better at the Romanian names,
That's not Romanian.
It's close.
If it was
it's all the
Yankochu.
Same. Oh, yeah.
Or Yankochevon.
I could say Shishefnu. Shishefnu.
No, it's not even close. Ceausescu. Yeah. That was adorable.
Nadia Comaneci.
Comaneci.
Mm. Damn. Bart Connor? Married him.
Who is Romanian by proxy.
Yes.
Because he married his fellow gymnast.
So if you were tuning in to hear about spring break and Romania, you have landed
you
in the right place.
You are so lucky. Like, what a comprehensive 3 minutes.
Back in a moment.
In-depth analysis. Insightful commentary. Probing questions.
What's a furry again?
I'll tell you.
Thinks they're an animal?
Sure.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Rachel Zegler, who plays Snow White, has been at the center of much of the backlash. Some fans railed against Disney for casting a Latina actor to play the character, terming the decision as woke. And after the election, Zegler issued an apology for making anti-Trump comments online. Also, her commentary on the original film, which she called dated, added to the fury. The portrayal of little people in the film also played a part, as several actors with dwarfism slammed filmmakers as being too politically correct for using CGI to create the iconic seven dwarves rather than real people. And actor Peter Dinklage questioned why the story even included the characters at all.
They're very proud to cast a Latino actress as Snow White.
Yeah.
But you're still telling the story of Snow White. And seven dwarves.
Sure.
So, take a step back and look at what you're doing there.
The worldviews of Zegler and co-star Gal Gadot are also seemingly at odds. Zegler promoting the Free Palestine movement, while Gadot, who was Israeli, passionately defending her home country.
What a mess. I can't wait for Snow White to come out. Besides that, there's really no subplot. Kennedy's with me now. Now, Kennedy, you were not cast as Snow White, so you refused to see
Shocking.
The movie.
You know, and it's like I got extra pale for the auditions.
Exactly.
You know,
that was your mistake.
I boned up on, you know, being a triple threat, singing and dancing and acting. Oh, no.
So you don't
not
cast.
Not good enough for Snow White.
Right. But you digress.
I'm on Gal Gadot's
side. Can you believe
this?
Can you believe this?
No, it's stupid. And it's like, there's not a ton of work for little people. So you could have seven massive breakout stars. You could have seven future Peter Dinklages. And maybe that's why he's defensive, because he wants to own that lane. And I get it. I understand it.
But he's for hiring little people.
Of course. I mean, wouldn't you rather see actors
proving
how incredible and full of heart they are? as opposed to CGI, which we see enough of already.
Do you think this is the last gasp
yes.
of political correctness all put into one
here's what I think happened.
Casserole?
I think the Disney shareholders put a lot of pressure on management to get away from this DEI stuff because the storylines don't resonate with kids. You can't have an emotional connection with characters that are lecturing you. It's impossible. So it's like, you know, everything has to be a teachable moment. And kids don't want to see that. They want escapism.
Right.
They want to see themselves. They don't want to be told that they're oppressors. So all of these, you know, forced plots have failed. And I think this was something that is a relic of the past woke DEI Disney hegemony.
So pull it. I mean, how much did you invest in this ungrateful pro-Palestinian
dollars to make that movie? Mm. And so they didn't even have a premiere. They had handpicked members of the press who weren't going to ask mean questions.
Right.
And they had a very small screening. They didn't even have a London premiere. So
what, are you surprised, like Jimmy Fallon, who is for this political correctness,
he loves
wasn't
DEI.
Asked to work? Yeah. He wasn't asked to work the red carpet, and you feel as though you got to defend him?
Yeah, I do, because how dare you? First of all, how dare you?
Whatever that means. I don't know what's next, but I'm going to any statement that starts like that, I have no idea
what's
next.
You don't even have to finish it, because people just feel guilty and then walk away.
But how great were you on the co-anchor quiz?
I feel like I triumphed thanks to the platform that you gave Jimmy and me. And so this was tough.
On
but
One
I was
Nation.
At a disadvantage because I just had to go by memory. Jimmy doesn't have a Wikipedia page. He doesn't have there aren't a ton of articles about him. I read every article I could find about him, and still the answers to your questions were not in there.
Right. And I got a pushback. Ainsley and Lawrence are next.
Oh,
and
nice.
She says it's anti-woman. I'm anti-woman because I gave you fill-ins and Jimmy got multiple choice.
That's true. I did not get multiple choice, and he did. And I was like, and the multiple choice for him were gimmies. Like, he should have gotten them right off the bat.
Right. But you have the most interesting. I kind of blew it. I should have stopped down and made you expand on every. I had no idea of any of those things. Murphy Brown had a character after you.
McGovern. Yep.
And were you consulted on this, or did you figure it out?
I was mortified because this was not, like, she was clearly, like, making fun of me. This was not a celebration of my Republicanness.
So you're not happy was a question.
Oh, no, I don't mind. I mean, now I look back and I'm like, who cares? That's pretty cool. But back then, you know, it's like I was, like, what, 23? And it was like, oh, my God, everyone's making fun of me. And my fear was after leaving MTV, I would never work again.
Right.
Because, you know, I basically stumbled into the job. It's not like I had a communications degree and went to broadcast school or anything like that. I had been a part-time DJ for a year. Like, that was my experience before I got hired at MTV. And then...
And you became this megastar.
Well, the first Rolling Stone readers poll that came out after I got there, after a couple months, I was voted most hated VJ. And I was like, that's it. They're going to fire me. And my boss called me and was like, this is great. They know who you are. And then the next year, I was most hated and most loved.
Wow. That's, and now, what
take
do you
that,
say?
America.
Actually, America told you.
Yeah, they, we're 50-50. They sort of gave it to
it
me.
It is a 50-50 country.
That's true.
Right. And by the way, America will answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they'll have a retort to that. But you also, then you did a game show?
Mm-hmm.
Which game show was that?
It was based on John Nash's Prisoner's Dilemma, and that's how I put myself through college. I did a game show for Game Show Network. I did a few of them. I actually hosted in 2003... Who Wants to Be Governor of California, the debating game. And we had, like, total oddball gubernatorial candidates, like Gary Coleman and Mary Carey, who was a porn star, and Nate Walton, who was Bill Walton's son, and a guy who only wore blue, and the youngest candidate, and the oldest kid. It was great. That was so much fun. And the porn star won.
And the porn star won.
Yes, she did.
I don't remember her reign. Was that in between? Was that in between Schwarzenegger and
Gray Davis?
And Gray Davis.
It was very, very narrow reign.
Well, that's so interesting. So, I mean, and now John Stossel brings you into news, correct?
Yes.
How?
I had gotten to know John. I had been on his show a couple times, and I'm very lucky I'm here because after the first appearance, he told his producer, "That woman talks way too much. She talks too fast. Never book her again." And, you know, luckily his producer like, nah, give her a shot. And then I sort of wore him down. And then we were at Reason Weekend in a hot tub in Puerto Rico. And that's where we came up with the idea for the show, The Independents. And that was in 2012. And then that summer, he wanted me to be his correspondent at the conventions. And Fox said, well, we don't send people who aren't Fox News contributors. So my agent was like, we'll make her a contributor. And they did. And that's how I started at Fox.
So a couple of things. If I can go back.
Mm-hmm.
We were in a hot tub with John Stossel.
That's right.
Brainstorming?
Brainstorming. It was not just me and the Stoss.
Did you ever thought going to the library? Do you ever thought going to a diner?
In Puerto Rico?
Yeah.
No, you either go to the beach or a hot tub. And then we played beach volleyball the next day.
He was good, right? He was good.
He's amazing. So he gave us like a beach volleyball clinic. And I had the I was serving for the losing point. He didn't talk to me for the rest of the trip. He takes beach volleyball so seriously. He wouldn't look at me and he wouldn't talk to me.
How do we promote your podcast?
It's called Kennedy Saves the World. It's on FoxNewsPodcast.com, Spotify, Apple. You can find it on YouTube.
What about your live shows with Jimmy?
I'm doing one April 19th at Mohegan in Pennsylvania in Wilkes-Barre. Like everyone says it a different way.
Yeah.
And I thought it was Wilkes-Barre. Like that's how I read it. And someone was like, no, it's Wilkes-Barre. Like what is wrong with you?
Where do we go to see you in person to order those tickets? Because it's not free. You will not talk to people unless they buy a ticket to talk to you.
No, you can go to Fox Cross America and they sell tickets there. That's Jimmy's radio show.
Okay. You gotta close a little harder.
You're telling me, man. I'm like Garrett Cole. I need Tommy John surgery.
Right. Garrett Cole's pitcher in the Yankees.
That's right.
I don't like the whole sports thing. It scares me. All right. Hey, listen, Sid Rosenberg's.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
All right, we are back. Sid Rosenberg's here from WABC. Sid in the Morning, number one show in all the land in New York City. Many people think it's the number one city, certainly in population. Although, Sid, did you see 4 people killed on subways? Hit by subways in 24 hours yesterday?
Yeah.
I thought the subways were getting safer.
Well, the mayor keeps telling us how crime is down, the subways are safer, everything is great in New York City, and it's not true. You know, it's all perception, it's not reality, and they get these numbers. And look, I like Jesse Tisch. I think the NYPD Commissioner Jessica Tisch is doing a very, very good job trying to clean up a mess that Mayor Adams caused in this city. It's not easy. But the truth is, these numbers don't reflect what's really going on in New York City.
What do you think?
Still scary.
What do you think is going on? You think they're messing with the numbers?
Oh, I think they always do. You know, I mean, this goes back to the Bratton Kelly days. I think that's nothing new. But I just know people are afraid, Brian. So even if the numbers are somewhat accurate, it doesn't matter. People are afraid to take the subways, to walk the streets, to be in New York City. Not you. You're a big, strong, tough guy, but a lot of people are afraid to be in New York City.
Right, except me.
Except for you.
So, by the way, when you leave at like 3 in the afternoon, usually that's a lot of trouble. But for you and I, we're never going to get in trouble. Because we got to get up in the middle of the night to do our show in the morning.
That's right.
And we're not going to get in trouble.
No.
That's the old Sid.
That's the old Sid. I mean, the new Sid was in the city last night very, very late.
Really?
I was in Chelsea. I was celebrating a Purim party. That is the Jewish Halloween. Oh. That is the holiday that's going on right now today. It's called Purim. And a lot of Jews get all dressed up and celebrate like Halloween. And we had a huge party in Chelsea last night, about 650 people. And we party till the break of dawn.
But you don't really party like you used
to. No, I don't do anything. My party is a Diet Coke, take like 1,000 pictures, wave to the fans, hop in an Uber, home by 10:30.
Right. So let me ask you, is it hard not to drink around people?
It used to be like 10 years ago, but not anymore. I don't miss it. In fact, I love it when I see people who are out all night, come to work the next day, or on a Saturday morning at the gym, they look like crap, they feel like crap. I feel like $1 million.
Absolutely.
I don't miss it even a little, Brian.
So do you know this? We are in a state without a governor. Because I didn't want to alarm you, but our governor, who's provided such great leadership, is in Washington, D.C., meeting with President Trump today. Governor Hochul, he kind of likes her. He says some nice things about her, but she wants to get reinstated. This congestion pricing. She thinks New Yorkers want this toll.
Well, I will say this. Last night, I came from Queens. I got into the city in 43 minutes. On a Thursday night, that used to be impossible. So
you are liking that?
I like the fact there's a lot less traffic, but it's a horrible deal for New Yorkers. First of all, again, it didn't go from 15 to 9. It went from 0 to 9. Secondly, businesses inside that area are dying. They're struggling because no one's coming into the city. So the economic impact of this congestion pricing kills local businesses because no one's coming. We're not talking about that. And the truth is, the traffic in Brooklyn, Staten Island, the other areas is twice as bad. So all you get is for about 20 blocks, you get less traffic. Everything else is bad.
So you should know this. Even though we're talking about New York, you could be coming to a city near you. New York does things first. So if you think, well, those New Yorkers, it's coming. You're going to tell me Chicago's not going to do the same thing?
Well, if they're Democrat cities, yes. These idiot Democrat mayors and Democrat states, they'll do that. But any city with a half a brain, any state with a half a brain, they're not going to do it. Because it didn't work in London. It's not really working in New York City. After a while, they're going to figure out it just doesn't work.
Like, so, for example, if I drive a truck and I deliver bread to the delis, or I deliver any type of product, so if I'm getting hit $9 to bring my truck through, I'm going to charge the buyer, and the buyer's going to charge the customer.
Correct. Everybody gets screwed in this. Even Big Macs are more expensive in that area right now because McDonald's trucks got to come through. So, yes, for a couple of people, the traffic is less, but the whole economic outlay is a disaster.
But you're a fitness guy. What are you having Big Macs for?
Well, every once in a while I do cheat, Brian.
Right.
I mean, I know I'm beautiful, but you got to cheat once in a while.
Well,
right?
Let me ask you something. Do you ever have those veggie burgers? Those,
never. Those never do that.
Grass-fed meat, whatever?
No. I don't even need a turkey burger anymore. If I'm going to have a burger, I'm going to have a burger, a real burger.
Right.
Or else I'll just stay away from it.
Right.
But turkey, you know, veggie burgers and these patties, they're like green, which is good for Monday, but not for ordinary days.
So President Trump has an agenda, and he's going to ask her this. Cut 38.
There's got to be funding behind doing something like this, and it seems like the same people who have been funding all the chaos on campuses that have been terrifying to Jewish students, that have prevented people from going and learning, are probably the same people funding this, probably the same people who funded the Summer of Love protests, of course, we all remember.
Well, we're working on one project. It should be very easy. It's a pipeline going through a small section of New York. New York's held it up for years, actually, for years. They wanted to do it for years and years. And it will reduce the most expensive energy almost in the world is in New England, because they have no way of getting it there because it's been held up by New York. And the whole of New England and Connecticut and New York, the energy prices are through the roof. And this one pipeline will save per family $2,500 just on heating, and another $2,500 on everything else.
So he wants to just get this pipeline to go through New York. And he's going to tell her to do it. And do you think she's going to say yes? She's going to say no.
No, she's going to say maybe. Because, you know, he's the art of the deal. He's the best. But she's coming to make a deal, too. She'll say, okay, you want the pipeline. I don't really like it. But here's what we'll do. Congestion pricing is $5. Not $9, $5. And you're going to leave me alone. That's what's going to happen today. There's going to be some type of compromise, some type of give and take. You could do your pipeline, but now Sanctuary City, don't bother me. Congestion pricing, don't bother me. That's how I think the negotiation starts.
You saw, well, I would think he's got to get the Sanctuary City thing handled. I know it comes from the city, right? From the city.
Yes.
But you saw Tom Homan up in Albany this week. And Tom Homan was being protested and screamed at by some lunatics who don't want him collecting illegal aliens.
Not just some lunatic, a guy that is a New York State assemblyman that is running for mayor and right now is probably third on the favorite list behind Andrew Cuomo and Eric Adams, a guy by the name of Zoran, don't mess with the Zoran, Mamdani. He's got about $3 million in his account already. This was the guy yelling and screaming in Tom Homan's face.
Yeah, I mean, and Tom Homan was eating an apple staring at him. Which
couldn't
is
care
pretty
less.
Cool.
Yeah, he'd knock him out James in Bond-ish. 2 seconds. Yeah, right. Like James Bond, exactly.
But, I mean, are you seeing some of these hotels empty out? Because they're saying these facilities are emptying out. Is that happening?
It is happening. The Roosevelt Hotel, for example, yes. It's happening slow. It's not happening overnight. But it's going to happen. Tom Holman's doing a terrific job. But I do think that, again, back to Trump and Hochul, you said earlier you think he likes her. I don't think he likes her. You know, he promised if he won, he would do business with New York. Democrat mayor, Democrat governor. He wants to improve New York. President Trump loves New York. Don't confuse the issue. I know he's in D.C., lives in Mar-a-Lago. He loves New York City. He wants to fix it. He'll work with Adams. He'll work with Hochul. But I think saying he likes them is probably a stretch.
All right. I want you to hear how it's the protester sounded like yesterday. Cut 27. So these protesters took over the lobby of the Trump Tower. Evidently, it is open to the public because they don't pay taxes on it. So they took advantage of that. They got zip-tied and moved out. But they were chanting, Sid, free Muhammad, Mahmoud, I guess, because he's an illegal alien with a green card, 31 years old, still a student at Columbia.
Still living there.
In campus housing, organizing all these protests.
Yeah.
Tell me what's going on here.
Well, it seems to be the trend in New York. I'm going to give you three names. Have fun with these three. One, George Floyd, okay? Summer of 2020. We know he was murdered in Minnesota. Some say no. Terrible idea by Shapiro, by the way. Do not pardon him. But either way, some say, you know, he wasn't murdered. But the truth is, there are statues of Floyd in Brooklyn, New York, right here in New York. Then we go to Luigi Mangione. This guy, walked up to a guy in cold blood, shot him in the back and killed him, and they love him. They can't get enough Mangione in New York City. Now you get this guy, a legitimate terrorist sympathizer, Mahmoud Khalil, and they love him. Do you see what's going on here in New York City? Right outside where we work, Brian, Mangione, Floyd, Khalil, they become heroes. That's terrifying.
Well, we have a president that's not going to tolerate it. And what is Columbia's reaction? They lost $400 million last week, and they're going to lose more, and they're trying to show that they're taking this threat seriously.
Well, they are, because yesterday they talked about expelling their students. They talked about suspending their students. They're talking about even revoking
from
last year when they broke into Hamilton House. So now Columbia is starting to feel that $400 million pain, which is good, and this is why Trump cannot stop. You start with Khalil. There's a lot of Khalils out there. Trust me, Brian. You start with Columbia. There's probably 60 other universities out there. You got to keep going. So Trump is off to a great start, but this has to be just the very beginning of cleaning up what is a much bigger situation than most Americans
know. But
don't
you think these colleges got to be a threat and start doing their own cleanup?
I think if you ask them to do that, that's unrealistic. When you make them pay, when you take the money away, when there's pain, they will do it because these colleges really believe in this stuff. They do. They believe in free speech. They believe in pro-Hamas supporters. They're only doing this, Columbia, because they're about to lose $400 million.
So let's get the mind of the protester. Let's explore it. Here's Eric Shawn, Cut 29.
Why did you pick Trump Tower?
Well, we are here protesting against the defamation and deprivation of Mahmoud by Donald Trump. I don't really understand what Donald Trump's intentions are, and I won't speak for them, but I will say that the impact is causing a lot of harm to people who are asking for peace. And
okay.
I think
do you want to take this witness?
She's a moron. She's
Thank
an
you.
Absolute moron.
No argument.
Listen, there's 8 million people in this
Peace?
City. Peace. There's about 200 people that showed up at Trump's tower yesterday. Very minimal compared to the amount of people in this city. Most, 7.8 million people realize this guy's a horrible person, that you 200 people look like idiots. And the fact that you're out there right now supporting a guy that glorifies October the 7th, he glorifies it. He's out there handing out pamphlets. He talks about Hamas like they're a really good, solid group. He is a terrorist. So at the end of the day, this girl speaks for about 200 people. We speak with 7.8 million.
Right. Absolutely. So why are they loud? Does it blow you away that Democrats are rallying to Khalil's side?
Yes, it kills me. I mean, you had this guy, Mamdani, third in the mayor race, yelling at Tom Homan. You've got Andrea Stewart Cousins. She's up there in Albany with Carl Heasty. She's part of the bail reform issue here in New York City. She's come out and support this guy. And even other Democrat officials aren't killing him. Where's Mayor Eric Adams going, this guy needs to be deported? He has said no. nothing. The governor, she has said nothing. And then you get Chuck Schumer, who's a Jew. He has said nothing. So the Democrats continue to not only support these people, but encourage these people sometimes by saying absolutely nothing.
So Sid Rosenberg is on every day on in the mornings at WABC, number one. And also, he's going to be on One Nation Sunday at 10 o'clock.
I'm very excited about this.
With Tommy Lahren.
She's awesome. You're
going
to sort it downstairs.
You're going to play the man. She's going to play the woman.
Isn't that usually the case every day, though?
Yes.
It would be different if I was going to play the woman and she was going to play
True.
The man.
You're saying I shouldn't have said that. Back in a moment.
Breaking news. The latest headlines. Exciting commentary.
People are aroused. I haven't seen people so aroused in a very, very long time.
It's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Sid Rosenberg here from WABC. He's going to be on One Nation this weekend at 10. I can't wait to get you out here. Sid's wearing a great vest. If you're not watching him on the stream, you're really losing out.
Wait till you see my shirt. It's a great shirt and a great vest, but I've got a light blue Israel color sport jacket that I'm wearing underneath over this on the TV show.
Serious stuff. Are we getting Alexander out of there?
We are.
Out of Gaza. He's the American still being held.
Well, when you ask me that, you have to assume that I trust Hamas. They said we are. They're sending back five, including Edan Alexander and four bodies. So the good news is, if you've been watching, his parents have been really, really strong, really emotional. It does look like Edan Alexander is on his way back.
Were
yes.
you against Adam Bowler meeting with Hamas?
I was. I didn't like what Adam Bowler had to say. I didn't like the meeting very much. I was actually disappointed. I know Adam's a good guy. I know Adam's heart is in the right place. But I thought, for the most part, that whole thing was a disaster, and he should not be meeting with Hamas.
Did not go over well in Israel.
No, it didn't. Israelis don't like to see that. Israelis, you know, they want the hostages home, but they still abide by the old, we don't negotiate with terrorists.
So what happens after? What happens after this is done, whatever it is? And the question is, Gaza can't be in charge. We all agree on that. How do you feel about the international community coming together saying, we will help rebuild it, Hamas will not be in charge? I'm talking about the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, yeah, Qatar, Jordan.
I mean, that's what we want, right? We don't want Hamas to be in charge. I don't trust any of those countries when they say that. I know they've said it over the last 2 weeks. I don't necessarily trust them, but that's the whole plan here. No matter what happens, whether we take over that territory, Donald Trump, and he builds, you know, Mar-a-Lago out there in Gaza, or one of these other countries you're talking about, the main thing that has to happen here is that Hamas never has any power again. That's it. I don't care if it's Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, President Trump, it doesn't matter to me. I just need to know that area will be done with Hamas and done with Palestinian leadership.
Are people starting to go back to their homes in northern Israel?
They are starting to go back to their homes. Yes, they are. Yes.
Because there's a less of a fear of Hezbollah now?
There is no fear. That's over. I mean, that's basically over. So you got the northern part of the country, fine. Southern part of the country, Gaza, obviously that's still going on. And even the central part of the country, which you call the West Bank, I call it Judea and Samaria, fighting in places like Jenin, even that's calmed down just a bit. So really, once you go north of Gaza, from the central part, Judea and Samaria, through the north to Lebanon, it's much less dangerous than it was 3 months ago.
So Sid, you're a huge force in New York, and there's a high-profile mayor's race going on. Eric Adams, who's trying to get himself out of legal trouble permanently. We also know that Adrian Adams is going to be running, and we also know that Andrew Cuomo is going to be running for mayor. And how could Andrew Cuomo be running for mayor with the way he was kicked out of office for his work as governor?
The real question you should be asking is not how can he run for mayor. How is he up by 25 points? It's not going to be close. Eric Adams, I'm going to say it for the millionth time, maybe the first time to your audience, he's got no chance. Zero. I don't care how much Trump backs him, Holman, Christine Ohm, John Katzmatidis. Zero. Approval rating 19%. Democrats don't like him. Republicans don't trust him. He's finished. Asian Adams, head of the city council, I don't see it. So the truth is, the question is, not how is he running, how is he going to win, which I think he will, by a landslide.
You spent quality time with him, talk to him. Has he learned anything as governor? The thuggish attitude in which he ruled, the no cash bail, the no oil and gas close down Indian Point. Now we got to go get energy from Canada. Listen,
my guy is Curtis Sliwa. I'm endorsing Curtis Sliwa enthusiastically. He's a Republican.
Great.
He'd be great. 47 years, Guardian Angels. When you sit with Andrew Cuomo, as I've done many times, at lunch or at dinner, he's a different guy. That guy will cry. He'll talk about his father, Mario. He'll start to cry. He'll actually show some remorse about the deaths in the nursing homes. But when you get him outside, like in front of Elise Stefanik in Congress, or you get him doing an interview on television, he's more of that defiant guy that you just described.
Well, how about this? How about the bad guy? Has he learned anything? Will he be moderate?
I think he'll be somewhat moderate, but not moderate enough.
Sid Rosenberg, you should run for mayor, except for WABC would never give you up. And you should really be getting paid. You do all this for free, right?
I do everything for free, even my morning show.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by the founder of the Stewart Group, Don Stewart, to discuss insights on President Trump's latest projects. Available now on FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.